Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Hi, and welcome to the HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Linda Palacio, your host of A Taste of the Past, where each week we take you on a journey through culinary history. We're broadcast live every Thursday at noon, or you can log on to HeritageRadioNetwork.com and search the archives for any of our shows and play them at any time. And I want to remind you, too, that you can call in at 718-497-2128. And our sponsor today is Fairway, like no other market. We are very pleased to have Fairway as our sponsor. And on today's show, A Taste of the Past, you might be tuning in and listening to this, who knows, next March, I don't know. But today we're live, and it's December 17th. So we're really in the midst of the holiday season. And I thought I would talk a little bit about the holiday season because we have a guest who's going to talk about drinking and what else happens during the holiday season. A lot of drinking happens during the holiday
God,
season.
God, I hope so.
Interesting because it always was a festival like that. Christmas time was not celebrated. A lot of people attribute Christmas celebration as we know it now to Charles Dickens, really, in around 1843. You know, he set the stage in the Christmas Carol. And really, Christmas was not a major celebration in England or any part of Europe. They always celebrated. People back into the ancient Roman times celebrated the winter solstice or the celebration of the sun, Saturnalia. And that was always a huge celebration in many cultures for centuries. But not until really the 1800s did... Actually, Constantine, when Constantine converted to Christianity, he was one of the first to try to bring a celebration of the Christian birth of Jesus in with the festival of the pagan festival of the winter solstice. That really didn't take off. That was, back in 600 and 800 AD. That really didn't take off. The celebration began to grow, and it really wasn't until the early 19th century that Christmas time and the holiday season, as we know it and call it, took off in force, and we have the major celebrations. So today we have a very special guest to talk about not just the holiday season of drinking, but we associate holiday seasons with punch. Often you go to parties and there's always a punch. So we have somebody here today who's going to give us the lowdown and the background of punch, and his name is David Wondrich. So when we come back, I'll tell you more about him, and we'll look forward to talking about punch.
Thank you.
Hi, and welcome back to A Taste of the Past on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Our guest today is David Wondrich, and David is one of the nation's foremost authorities on the history of the cocktail. And I say that very confidently because I've known David for quite a while and tasted a lot of his cocktails. but to his credentials are a list of supporting events, and one of them in particular is that he was the founding member of the Museum of the Cocktail, which opened in 2005 in New Orleans. And he, as a former English professor, he has taken off to doing a lot of writing, and he wrote Esquire Drinks, an Opinionated and Irreverent Guide to Drinking, as well as a new edition of Jerry Thomas's 1862 How to Mix Drinks, or The Bon Vivant's Companion, which was the first cocktail book ever written, and back in 1862. And I'll let David tell us more about that. And David, you can chime in on your past about different things. But I chose David to talk particularly about punch. He had done another program for the Culinary Historians of New York about punch, and I was so impressed with his depth of knowledge that I said, "Ah, would be a great radio program." And what I would like to do before I speak to him directly is read you a quote of something that David wrote in The Snail, which is a journal of Slow Food USA, and he named it The Flowing Bowl. Punch has become a catch-all, a random assortment of sliced fruits and soft drinks charged up with beverage alcohol, sweetened without mercy, and ladled into tiny-handled couplets grasped precariously by people who would rather be drinking just about anything else. Yet for almost two centuries, from the late 17th to the mid-19th, it was the sovereign ruler of the kingdom of mixed drinks, a noble compound whose assembly was an art governed by exacting rules and rewarded by fame and money. And David, this kind of leads us right into the fact that you are in the midst of writing a book on punch. Is that right?
Absolutely. The presentation I did for you and the article I wrote for The Snail kind of got me interested in this. And I intended in my last book, the book about Jerry Thomas, to have a huge section on punches because he had one. And it turned out the more I looked into it, the more I realized that the story of punch was not an American one, it was an English one, and it really didn't fit into the Jerry Thomas book, so I reserved it, and now I'm trying to turn that into a book, and I'm almost done with it, thank God, and hope we'll see what happens with that.
But did punch was has a broader background than just English, right? I mean, we read recipes from punch from many countries.
Well, there's punch and there's punch. Many countries had recipes like Hippocras, which was a French thing, a spiced wine. There were lots of spiced wines and spiced thises and thats and mixed drinks with based on ale and mead and so on and so forth. But true punch was the first mixed drink to achieve, let's say, global popularity based on distilled spirits. And it was an English invention as far as discoverable.
When you say it was, I mean, it was governed by exacting rules and rewarded by fame and money. I mean, people were paid to mix punches?
Oh, there were punch houses all over the English colonies in the East, all over the English colonies in the West Indies, and soon by the late 1600s, all over England itself. And the proprietors of these places, of the famous ones, had long and important careers. They were the first celebrity mixologists. And, you know, as such, it was a good living. If you were a man like, let's say, James Ashley, who opened the London Punch House in 1731 and died many, many years later, a prosperous and well-respected man in a local institution.
Interesting. When did it become this fruity? I had to laugh when I was reading the article. People who would rather be drinking just about anything else. You know, you go to holiday parties or, you know, any kind of parties, wedding receptions or whatever, and there's always that inevitable bowl of punch. Mm-hmm. And people seem to steer clear of it and go to, you know, the table with the alcohol. When did it become this fruity, syrupy yuck?
Well, starting in the Victorian era, punch began to get displaced. it comes into England in the 1680s from the colonies and from abroad. It really becomes popular. And for a good 100 and almost 150 years, it was a dominant social drink. And as such, people drank a lot of it. That meant that it's like the old, there was an old American gambler's thing that you would bet somebody they couldn't eat a quail a day for 30 days. And you would think, oh, that's so easy. A tiny little quail, no problem. But, you know, quails are kind of gamey. And after about day 8, you're pretty sick of quail. And by about day 15, you're extremely sick of it. And, you know, something kind of similar happened to punch is once it fell out of daily use, people started, you know, in the Victorian era, they didn't have time to sit around and drink bowls of punch and get sozzled all day. They had to go out and work. And once it fell out of daily use, it became a special occasion thing. And so people started tarting it up because it was a special occasion. They'd put more fruit in it or more spices or splash in all kinds of rare liqueurs and things like that. And it becomes pretty cloying once you do that.
Indeed.
I mean, the original punch is very simple. And I actually brought some that we'll taste a little bit later. But it's a noble beverage, and it's not it's by no means fruity, let's say.
Well, in the job of those in the let's say the late 17th century, 18th, early 18th century, who were actually paid and ruled to mix. I mean, this was the royal court was hired and assigned people to be punch mixers.
Well, the royal court not so much, although because punch was a little low and a little bit sporty for royalty. however, gentlemen of all sorts, the younger sportier set certainly drank it, eventually, it even infected the royal court. George IV, the Prince Regent, George III's son, was a famous punch drinker to excess by all means, and he had his Mr. Madison, who made him punch and bottled it up for him, but that was a good century later. In the early days, punch was still something a little bit louche, and it was good for young gents out on a spree, but it wasn't. It wasn't a formal thing.
Well, you mentioned that you brought some punch. What were the early punches really made of that we recognize?
Originally, it was a very simple drink. It was spirits, and you know they only had certain kinds of spirits were used in it. That's partly because that's all they had. In its origins, it goes back to the English. Colonial experience, the English trade with India and Indonesia, when it was invented, it used local spirits, either distilled from rice or molasses or some combination of those, or palm tree sap, palm wine, which would be distilled in India. And so that stuff is all collectively known as arak. That was the original,
arak, right.
The original spirit for punch. And then when it moved to England, those things became very expensive. And they switched to smuggled French brandy or rum from the Caribbean or even whiskey out in Ireland and up in Scotland.
Well, arak, isn't that having a sort of a renaissance now? Are there people producing that?
It's come
today?
Back to the U.S. I mean, arak is a blanket term for any spirit from, I mean, it's like saying liquor. It's any spirit from the Middle East out through Indonesia is arak. And the kind that we mostly know is the Middle Eastern type, which is an anisette, basically. But in the East, it's not sweetened or flavored with anything other than what it's made from. And that's starting to come back into the U.S. after a very long time.
Well, why don't we try a little bit of what you've brought here? And
let's see. It's in an elegant punch bowl, we shall pretend.
Right. If I can tell you the plastic bottle he's pouring it from.
There's a little splash for you.
Okay.
And a little splash for me.
And is there something appropriate?
Cheers.
We say cheers.
Cheers is always good.
Wassail.
Wassail.
Okay. And you're going to hear me slurp here. Remember, it's still only noon, and I'm drinking. Whoa. That's a strong punch.
This is a strong punch, yes. But the solution then is to add a little water to it, which was always the case. Punch.
Okay, we're gonna add a little water to this, and we will continue with our wassail when we return. Hi, welcome back to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Linda Palacio, and you're listening to A Taste of the Past with our special guest, David Wondrich, a drink historian. And we're in the midst of our holiday celebration with a little wassail. You know, it's interesting. I was thinking, what is wassail anyway? You know, hear all these songs about here we come a caroling and to you, your wassail too. And turns out wassail was basically an old English greeting, right? About mm-hmm. a salutation to good health. And of course, when you salute somebody to good health, you usually give them a cup of something.
I should hope so.
Yeah. So from saluting someone to good health, it turns out to then, in popular meaning, take on this meaning of a huge punch bowl, the wassail mm-hmm. bowl. Right?
Absolutely.
And I guess they had a lot of people to greet, so they had a big bowl.
You know, they lived in communities. It took a village to empty the bowl.
Okay. Well, we were, just before we went to break, we're in good spirits now, just before we went to break, Dave poured us a sample of what would have been a historic punch, and I think it just knocked my head off. Tell me what's in this punch.
Well, not enough water for one thing, and okay. That was my mistake. I'll talk about that in a moment. But we have Indonesian arak in here,
okay.
Jamaican rum, sugar, brown sugar, you know, dark raw sugar, lime juice, water, and nutmeg.
Whoa, this is not the punch you usually drink at those baby showers, let me tell you.
No, this is punch for people who like to drink. Woo. But, however, I didn't put enough water in it, and that's important, because punch, when it came out, when it was first achieved popularity, the whole point of it was that it shouldn't be too strong, that it should be like wine. It was a way of making artificial wine.
Oh.
It was a way of taking distilled spirits, which were considered, let's say, low base and therefore disgusting, and turning them into something a gentleman could drink.
And, of course, ice would not have been an issue.
Not very much. If available, it would have been used because they did ice things, but it was rare.
Mm-hmm. So it would be diluted with water? And
mm-hmm. It could be served hot. You could do it with boiling water, cold as we're having it, or pretty much room temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole point of it was that it shouldn't be so pungent that you can't drink a lot of it. It should be toned down to the point where it just slides down smoothly with enough of the tang of the spirits to make it interesting, and the acidity of the citrus there to kind of restore some of that acidity we get in a good wine.
Well, it does, aside from being very strong, it tastes really good. I mean, the combination of the citrus and the brown sugar with the alcohol works. And that is one of the problems I know a lot of people complain about with today's punch, any kind of punch they do, whether they do a champagne mm-hmm. punch or a rum punch, is that it tastes so good. It slides down a little too fast too easily.
It's hugely intoxicating in the long run. I mean, the idea is that you shouldn't have just one glass of it. You should have about 20. And I've been looking through the records of the Old Bailey, the London criminal courts from the 1700s, rather. And it turns out gentlemen had a horrible propensity to drink too much of this, and then they would get quarrelsome, and seeing as they all wore swords at the time, there was an awful lot of people who stuck each other in the middle of the night with their swords and then went to trial for their lives over punch.
Wow, little has changed.
Yeah, exactly. It's there is that side to punch as well. It's a little bit rambunctious and rowdy, and should be respected.
Well, did it in fact fall out of favor over the years? I mean, legally or in any way, other than in the United States prohibition? But bring me along a little bit.
You know, once you get into the mid 19th century, that sort of heavy drinking, boozy behavior starts to become problematic, particularly in England with the Victorian years. There are new standards of propriety. Gentlemen and aristocrats can't just lay around all day drinking bowls of punch and riding roughshod over the rest of the population. They had to at least maintain some sort of sense of propriety, whether or not whatever they were doing behind closed doors is another matter, but they had to, you know, kind of behave publicly. And that was one aspect. Another is industrialization and a changing pace of city life meant that you needed to be a little more sober than you couldn't be just drunk from noon on, as or from the morning on, as was often the case.
Mm-hmm. Well, was punch ever, you said industrialization coming along, was punch ever bottled in, you know, like a pre-mixed form?
Well, that was one of the things that, that a household would do in, is to mix up huge vats of punch.
Like making your own wine.
Like making your old wine, and then you would bottle it and lay it down in the cellar, and it would keep just like wine does, and you would pull it out and heat it up and maybe add some more water to it to bring it down to drinkable proof. But bottled punch was a common thing, especially bottled milk punch, which was a...
Like a whiskey milk punch?
Well, it would be brandy mostly, brandy or rum, and you would pour milk into a hot bowl of punch and watch it curdle, and then you strain out the curds. And that leaves...
Must have tasted better than it sounds.
Oh, it's absolutely delicious, I have to say. Okay. It really is smooth and round and delightful, and it keeps for
now,
a long time.
Now, is this... You mentioned Bailey's list of events, but that Bailey's, that's not the same Bailey's that got into the liqueur menu.
Oh, no, different. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Because I was thinking of a cream milk-based drink.
No, this didn't, the old milk punch, which was actually invented by, supposedly, by Mrs. Aphra Behn, who was one of the great characters of the 17th century, and has, not only was she the first woman writer in English to make a living with her pen, she was also one of the founding mothers of mixology, it turns out, which is great.
Oh, interesting.
And the whole point of this is that it doesn't have the cream in it. It doesn't have that sort of milkiness to it. It just, the milk acts as a smoothing agent on the spirits. And it makes for a very delightful and smooth punch without having that heavy creaminess to it.
Well, you said that she was popular in the late 17th century. When do you attribute the first punch, I mean, like a punch being a popular drink. When do you attribute that?
Well, it's first invented sometime in the early 1600s, as far as we can tell. And then it's a sailor's drink and a drink at the various English commercial outposts in India and Indonesia. Then it moves to the American colonies because there's a lot of sea traffic in between. And then from there, it moves to England, and it really doesn't appear in England until the 1660s and doesn't really catch on for another 10 or 15 years, at which point it becomes pretty much universally popular.
Why do you think punch found its place on the table, mostly at just holiday time and celebrations in let's say, modern-day times, you know, early 20th century, I would imagine.
Well, I think people kind of had a memory that's been passed down of how fun it is and how great a punch party is. They just lost a lot of the know-how over the years. So they tried to recreate it, and the way it's mostly made now is kind of it's a large cocktail. It's a little too strong. It's a little too highly flavored to be satisfying for, you know, a long evening of drinking it. But I think, nonetheless, that idea of the communal beverage and the sort of the focus, the bowl as the focus for a party, has definitely remained in people's minds.
Mm-hmm. Well, you actually mixed for us at an event an individual glasses of punch. You did individual servings of punch that you mixed, much like a bartender would do
exactly, a
cocktail.
That also goes back. You could get punch in almost any size, from a large glass of it to a very large bowl of it. You know, if you went into a punch house in London in, say, 1720, you would have a full range of things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the bowl was the part that really caught people's imagination.
Right.
That was the fun part.
Uh-huh. And when did, and so, well, being the drink historian, you'll know the answer. When did people really start going more for the individual mixed cocktails, like the, you know, martinis or...
It's an American thing, and it really comes in the early 19th century here. And those habits of individualism and also in some way temperance, because you can stop it. When you have to get your drink by the individual dose, you can stop. If it's in a big bowl in front of you, you tend to drink it until it's gone.
<Not going, right?
laughs> No, that's one of the dangers of punch. And it's an American thing, and it spreads back to across the water to England and Europe by the late 19th century.
Huh. Well, the punches, I mean, there are what punches that you would consider classified as respectable punches have had the longest life. In other words, forget our, our fruity punches, our, you know, 7-Up in the mix punch.
Well, I think one of the oldest in circulation is Philadelphia Fish House Punch, which goes to the originally the colony in Schuylkill and then the state in Schuylkill once after the Revolution, which claimed to be an independent English colony and then an independent American state. And all it was a bunch of Philadelphia gents who got together around a large punch bowl and some griddles and have been doing it since sometime in the mid-1700s. And their punch is still widely disseminated and quite effective.
Oh, interesting.
And it's a very old style of punch.
Mm. Well, we will enjoy this holiday season with punch like we've never known it before. And I thank you for, let's click this so we can
click this,
hear it.
Wassail.
What?
Wassail.
Wassail to you too. And I thank Dave Wondrich. And I thank Fairway, our sponsor, for bringing us this program today. And once again, you're listening to the HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.